This is episode number 59 with Steve Sims. Welcome to the Rise Higher podcast. I'm your host, Stephanie Kwong, and each week I'll bring you an inspiring guest with an empowering message to help you rise higher and live your best life. Each guest shares their time of struggle and setback and what specific mindsets, tools, practices, or habits they use to overcome so that you can apply them to your life. This show is to remind you that you're not alone and that there's always a pathway up. Thanks for spending some time with me today. I'm grateful to be on this journey with you. Our struggles are a call for us to rise. So here we go. Let's dive deep now so we can rise higher together. Hello, my friends. Welcome to the Rise Higher podcast. Thank you guys so much for spending part of your day with me today. I know you're going to be really happy that you did when you hear not only the incredible story of my guest, Steve Sims, rising up from what would have been an ordinary life to create the mind-blowing extraordinary for himself and others, but today you're going to also get actionable strategies that you can take to achieve your goals and make anything you want happen. Now, before we get moving and grooving with Steve, I wanted to share with you guys that I launched my new website. Woo! And I've got a gift for you. I love giving gifts. I really do. So if you go to my website, stephaniekwong.com, you can download a free guided hypnosis audio that will guide you into harnessing the power of your mind and to align your energy so that you can manifest and attract all that you want with greater ease. Yep, it's a pretty incredible hypnosis track, if I do say so myself. And it's one that I've listened to manifest a lot of the amazingness that I have in my life. So if you want it, make sure you head on over to my website, stephaniekwong.com, to get it. All right, now today I've got the real life Wizard of Oz, Steve Sims, who literally pulls off the unimaginable. Now, Steve's been making his clients' wildest dreams come true, from getting married by the Pope in the Vatican to singing on stage with Journey, being serenaded by Andrea Bocelli, and connecting with powerful business moguls like Elon Musk are just a few of the many projects that he's worked on. Now, Steve is the visionary founder of Bluefish, the world's top luxury travel and lifestyle concierge firm. He's an expert marketer in the luxury industry and is the author of Bluefishing, The Art of Making Anything Happen. Now, with his unique talent for connecting with people's passions, opening doors, and making things happen, Steve's developed an exclusive reputation and an impressive client list of the world's rich and famous and other discerning individuals interested in living life to its fullest. Steve's been featured in Forbes, The New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Entrepreneur, Variety, Worth, CNBC, and many other media outlets. And he's also a keynote speaker at venues including Harvard and the Pentagon, and he's spoken at many top entrepreneurial groups, including Mastermind Talks, Genius Networking Events, and Entrepreneur Society of San Francisco. Now, Steve grew up as an Irish boy in East London and was the son of a brick mason. And this laid the foundation, yep, that pun was intended, for his insane work ethic. And you're going to hear the defining moment that happened for Steve to have him quit being a bricklayer and the steps along the way that he took to become the man who top corporate executives, celebrities, professional athletes, and other people turn to make their impossible possible. Now, today, you guys are also going to hear some of Steve's badass tips for life and business from his awesome book, Bluefishing, The Art of Making Anything Happen. Now, I bought that book and I read it in one night. It is so good. So this book is your guide showing you that anything is possible if you know how to achieve it. It's a how-to guide to make things happen and to get people to say yes. And Steve shares his practical tips, techniques, and strategies to help readers break down any obstacles and turn their dreams into reality. So you guys are going to hear some of those actionable strategies on the show today, along with some of the coolest stories of Steve's 20-plus year career. And he's going to talk about what the world's most powerful people really want. Now, you guys are definitely going to want to share out today's episode with a brilliant Steve Sims. In fact, if you share this episode out and tag me and Steve in the post, you'll be entered to win a free copy of his book. Now, I bought an extra one so I could give it out to you. Remember, I said I love giving gifts. I really do. So go ahead and share out this episode right now. Take a screenshot of this episode that you're listening to, write a little comment about the episode, and then tag me at I am Stephanie Kwong, and make sure you also tag Steve at Steve D. Sims. That's StevDSims, and post that baby up so that you can win a free copy of Steve's book. And I will make sure to announce the winner at the end of this week. All right, guys, let's do this. Here we go with Steve. Welcome, Steve Sims, to the Rise Higher podcast. It's such an honor and a pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
I've always loved seeing your Facebook posts and laughing at them, commenting, liking, but just so appreciative of who you are and what you teach and share in terms of your expertise. You have an internationally famous company, right, that makes once-in-a-lifetime events for the rich and the famous. And your job is really to make the impossible possible. And that's such a powerful metaphor for life. I think a lot of times people will look at the impossible and they'll step back from it, but you kind of lean right in.
Yeah. Many people, you're right. This word impossible seems to be part fear and part excuse. Mm. And people will just run away from it as though it's a way of just saying, no, it can't be done. You know, it can't be done because it's impossible. And that seems to be like their get out of jail free card. And I've always, there's a saying out there, it's only impossible until someone does it.
Exactly.
And I just fail to see. I think I've got a mixture of ignorance and stupidity to what it is that I'm doing. And I'll come back and people will go, how did you do that? And I'll be like, well, you know, I just spoke to this person. I didn't get scared of it. And I think that's where most people stop. They get petrified.
Yeah. It's like, you don't even see the blocks in your mind at all. You're just like, oh, what's the next step I can take? I mean, that's kind of some of the pieces I gathered
in
your book.
It's been one of these things that as I grew, I was a very, I class myself now as a very educated individual. But school had nothing to do with that. So as I left school, this was in the 80s and 90s, we didn't have Instagram to show off the cars you don't own or to show selfies of planes you don't own. We didn't have any of that pretense and fake it. So I just didn't know. I didn't know what Gucci was or Prada or anything like this. So I also wasn't scared of it. So as I did things and as I grew, that was where my stupidity and ignorance allowed me to just go forward without the fear of failing. As I grew, my clients were very successful, very powerful people. And a lot of people say the rich and famous. The rich and famous make up about 15% of my clients. Most of mine are the richer and unknown, you know. And they're very successful at not seeing the roadblocks and not seeing the reasons why it can't be done. And I got to get into their mindset. So I was very lucky that before I realized what I was doing was impossible, I was hanging around with a bunch of people that couldn't spell that word. And so it worked out well for me.
I would love for you to share kind of where you started to where you are now, because I know, you know, when I've, just from reading your book too, you were destined for the ordinary based off of your life circumstances, right? What you're born into, but you created the extraordinary. And it's beautiful to hear your journey along the way. And I'd love for you to share that.
Well, I think as I grew up, I yearned to be middle class. to say that we were working class family was an understatement. And I remember growing up in my teens and my late teens and early 20s, resentful of how poor I was. And I'll come back to that because that was actually very good for me. But I left school when I was 15, did not go to college, slept in for one day after finishing school. Second day, my dad wakes me up at like 4:45 in the morning and I'm on the road at 6 to a building site. Now, my family were construction workers, so they gave me kind of one day off before they went, right, well, you need a job, you've now got one, you're going to work on the building site. And I was thrown into it, but I didn't know any different, you know? Mm-hmm. It was just one of those things that just happened. And as the years went by, and I had a couple of years of working on a construction site, and you went to work and you got rained on. It was in London, so you got rained on, you were cold, you know, you broke your fingers and your thumbs from the bricks, or, you know, you stubbed your toe on stuff. It was a rough industry to be in. Yeah. But I was in it and I couldn't work out what was wrong with me, because like all entrepreneurs, we're diseased, we're misfits. We don't work. You know, there's something people say, and I love this. People go, oh, when did you realize you were an entrepreneur? No one realized they were an entrepreneur. You know, it's like, when did you realize you could see out your eyeballs? You just can, you know? And I think as I got older, I just realized where I didn't fit. And so like most entrepreneurs, we get aggravated really easy. We're short-tempered. We have zero patience. We have ADD on those things that don't engage us. So when I found something that engaged me, and usually it was a challenge, I was all in. You know, I would get 110% on something and 2% on something that did not interest me. And so I was constantly bouncing around trying to find things to do. I left the construction industry and I just knew that it wasn't right for me. I started working on the door of clubs. I started delivering cakes. I was an insurance salesman. I tried so many different things. And I'd go to work and I'd be like, I don't like this. And I'd go home. So, of course, my family are thinking, you know, he's going to go to jail. He's going to get in trouble. You know, he can't hold a job down. And I was that kind of kid. So at the time, I think I was the epitome of a wayward child. I didn't know where I fit. I was bouncing off of the walls, couldn't keep a job down, couldn't suffer friends, because if they didn't interest me, I didn't want to have anything to do with them. You know, just because I'd gone to school with them, didn't give them the right passage that I had to like them. Mm-hmm. So I was a very kind of misunderstood, bouncy kid until I suddenly started to find things that challenged me, until I started to find things that, oh, that interests me. Now you have my attention. And like all entrepreneurs, we need our attention grabbed. And the second it wanes, we're gone. So that's what it was. I was just bouncing off the walls, jumping in a bunch of different industries. And then as, I don't know if luck would have it, and I think a lot of it was luck, I constantly ended up back on the building site. Because it was, I would try and be away from it, and then I'd go back. And then I'd be back. And I was on the train one day, heading to a different part of London. There was a kid on the train, 19 years old. Tiny little pencil-y of a kid. But he had a watch on, and he had a briefcase, and he had a nice suit, and he looked sharp. And I'm there in my dad's old jacket. I've got my tools in my hand. You know, I've got my flask of tea for the day, just ready to basically get peed on for the day because it was cold and wet out. And I looked at this kid and I was staring at him. And I just thought to myself, I want to be you. I bet you're going to go to work and there's going to be, you're not going to get wet and cold. There's probably going to be girls that you can talk to. There's funny enough, no girls on the building site.
None?
No, funny enough, shock horror. But I was looking at this kid and I'm a, you know, big, ugly fella. And so that can sometimes intimidate people, especially if I'm on a train, I'm staring at someone, that can, you know, be intimidating. But he just walks over from the other side of the train and starts talking to me. And I'm thinking, who the hell are you? You know, he was not intimidated, was not scared, but worse, he made out he knew me and he knew my name. And I'm like, who the hell is this guy? I don't know. Apparently at school, he was getting thumped at school and I had apparently stepped in and stopped it and he had remembered it.
Wow.
Now, all these years later, he was like, oh, how are you? I remember when you did this. And I was like, I'm sorry, I really don't remember that, you know? And he was like, oh, I remember. I was like, well, you know, glad it all worked out. And I've always hated bullies, you know? And he turned around and he told me what he did, and he was a stockbroker. It was the year of Wall Street, you know, the movies, the cell phones that were the size of a briefcase. Some of them, do you remember the ones that were briefcases with a cable?
Yes.
It was that period. And he was a trainee stockbroker. So anyway, we saw each other on the train for a few more days, and then he told me about them doing a big internship at his bank because they were throwing a bunch of people over to Hong Kong because we'd gone from the bull market to what was now called the tiger market, which was Asia basically exploding. And so I bought my dad's suit and I went along for an interview. And I didn't think I was going to get it, but they were recruiting 160 people.
Wow.
So luckily, yeah. I kind of like, and every time they asked me a question like, well, can you talk about your history? I'd turn around and go, I really like your tie. Where'd you get your tie? And I would just deflect. And I managed to get it. And they actually, they gave me a ticket. They gave me a job. And they flew me out. And I left on the Thursday. What with the time difference? I didn't land until the Saturday. And I got drunk with them on the Saturday and the Sunday. Went to orientation on the Monday. And I was fired on the Tuesday. So it was a very short career. But now I'm in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
And the
funny Why were you fired?
Well, they realized I had no qualifications. They realized I knew nothing. And the funny conversation on the Tuesday was, do you have a copy of your certificate? And I'm like, no, I don't have that. No point in lying.
But I love your tie.
Yeah, I love your tie. Give me your tie. And they just, funny thing was, there were these two guys looking at each other, trying to work out which one of them was actually going to give me the news that I was fired. But then we all started laughing. And one of them turned around and they went, what did you think was going to happen? And I said, I didn't know, but I knew if I stayed at home, I'd be nowhere. So this was a shot in the dark. And the guy's like, well, here's the funny thing. Because we brought you here, we've got to give you a month's salary. Yeah, we've got to give you a month's salary and you get the apartment for 3 months.
Yes.
Now, there were about five or six other brokers in the apartment that hated me. They just looked at me as a fraud now. So I had to stay out all night until they went to work at 8 o'clock in the morning. Then I'd come back, sleep through the day, and then go back at night. So, of course, with that kind of schedule, what do you end up doing? You end up working on the nightclub doors again. And that's how it started. So I was now a doorman in Hong Kong, but kind of, even though that was similar, I kind of felt as though I'd broken the path or the pattern of bouncing back into building sites. And here was the thing. I said that I'd go back to it. When I was younger, all my family did what was necessary to survive. You know, I remember having takeaway food when I met my girlfriend at 18 years old. So we were not frivolous spenders. We knew what it was like to do two or three jobs a day. So whereas I thought I was poor as a youngster, all of those things had been built into me. So now working on the door and then afterwards maybe cleaning up a restaurant before I went back to the apartment, I was comfortable doing it. If I could have got a job cleaning the toilets down at a subway station, I would have done that because I wasn't scared of doing it. Now we're in a situation where the kids come home from college, they need to get a job. They won't go and scrub toilets because it's beneath them. For me, it was a way of making money. So I thought I was poor. I suddenly realized that I was actually just, financially challenged.
Good way of putting
it. But I was actually loved. There was never a day that I wasn't fed. I always went to bed warm, comfortable, knowing I was protected. And so I was actually richer in my childhood than I had first realized.
I love that, Steve.
That was a ramble for the story, so I apologize.
No, don't apologize. I asked. And I really love that you're just willing to do whatever it takes, too. I think some people have a perception of how it's supposed to look in order to step into something. And like you said, because of your upbringing, you're like, I'll go do that. It's not a big deal. But you didn't just do your job. You had an insight. So I want to pivot to your book because, guys, go get Steve's book, Blue Fishing. I'm going to talk the heck out of it on this episode because it's such a fantastic book. I bought it and I opened it up. I read before I fall asleep usually, and I thought I'd read a few chapters, and I read the whole entire book.
And I was like, oh, it's 1 a.m. You should probably go to bed now. But I felt so fulfilled because the book was just a really great book.
Thank you.
But in the book, you shared kind of how things opened up for you with Neptune 1, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But there's something that you did that started to change the game for you, and I'd love for you to share that.
I don't think it ever changed. My mentality never changed. And as I said to you in the beginning, as an entrepreneur, I knew where I didn't fit. And so I kind of knew where I was and I didn't like it. I knew where I had to go. And working on the door is a brilliant position to actually see life. You see the people walk up to you scared and intimidated. You see the people walk up to you confident. You can see those assholes that are really just out to, you know, either get a girl for the night, or, you know, it's a hen night, or it's a bunch of guys that are probably going to not handle their drink too well, or maybe had a few too many drinks before they've got into the club. The couple that are on their first date, the couple that have been together and it's date night, you know, you can see all these social demographics in one night. And it's quite interesting. And I remember working on the door and getting to see a few people and getting to see the regulars. And I really thought to myself, I want to be them. You know, they're wearing good clothes. They don't care what the bar tab's going to be. They're having fun. They're comfortable. They're confident. They're having good laughs. It was never them that I was called to. It was always the unconfident moron trying to prove himself with a couple of beers in himself that wanted to pick on a bouncer to pull his stripes. You know, that's what I always got, you know. So after a while, I thought to myself, I want to talk to these guys. How can I talk to them? Now, you can only ever have a conversation when you bring something to the conversation. You know, there's got to be a value. You've got to bring some game to it. And so I remember one day there was a club around the corner. And, of course, as a doorman, we were always being asked, oh, can you look after this club this night? Can you look after this bar? You were always hearing about the different things that were opening up. And there was this new club that had opened up, and a friend of mine was working on the door. And this group of guys and their girlfriends turned up, and they walked up, ready to walk through the door. And I said to them, oh, guys, not tonight. And I turned them away. And they looked at me. And they looked at me like...
the moment I'm talking about.
Yeah, they looked at me like I was just kicking them out of a club before they'd even gone in. I said, look, there's nothing wrong with you guys. And I know you're great clients here, but there's another club around the corner that's just opened up. I know it's going to be a little bit empty in here tonight because everyone wants to check out that place. And you won't be happy. And I'm concerned you'll think that's going to be normal and you won't come back again. So I'd like you to go around there, speak to Colin, tell him Sim sent you, and enjoy it, you know? So I'm just thinking about your night. And they were like, wow, thank you very much. And they gave me a tip and they went off. Now, the owner of the club came out and moaned about it. And I said, look, if they go in there tonight, you may lose them the following. They're going to hear about that other club,
yep.
You know? So you're going to lose them one of these nights. I'm gambling that they're coming back tomorrow night because we've actually sent them away for a better night. And they were like, oh, you better be right. And they did. They came back the following night. And they went, how is it tonight? I went, tonight's good. You know, how was last night? Was it good? You know, what did they do good? What did they do bad? And I started this conversation. And of course, as it grew and they would go, oh, there's a party. They would ask me then, there's a party at such and such. Do you know about it? And I'd be like, I didn't, but let me make some calls. And it just, I suddenly became like the oracle of where the good party was, because the old saying is they won't care till you show you care. I was focusing on that night. Now, all I was making was tips, but let's be blunt. I wasn't focused on that. My single solitary laser pinpoint goal was to be able to speak to rich kids. Yeah, you know, I wanted to speak to affluent, confident people with the idea that if I could communicate with them, become friends with them, and this was the gutsy ask, they would then offer me a job. Nice. So I had no other objective. I didn't care what your night was. I cared that if I could focus on the detail of it being good for you, then you'd want to keep talking to me, and eventually we would become friends, and you'd go, hey, Steve, I own a yacht charter company. You should come and sail my yachts. You should come and sell them. That's where I felt my career path was going to come. I was, without realizing it, building up a networking club. I was building up a Rolodex of affluent people. The funny thing is, I went from working on the door to throwing my own parties to taking over mansions, to taking over. So it exploded. But my goal was always the same, get 100, 200 of the richest expatriates in Hong Kong, Macau, Bangkok at this party, and one of them would offer me a job. Yeah, I was.
And you're not even seeing what you're already doing. You already created a business for yourself. No,
it was my wife that brought that to my attention. Wow. Because I didn't want poor people, because the bottom line of it is poor people can't afford things. And I didn't want to be poor. And you are the combination of the five people you hang around with. So why hang around with five poor people? You know, as I say, it's very horrible, but I'm that kind of primitive. You know, if you want to have scintillating conversation, don't hang around with five morons, you know, or five drunks. You know, it's very simple, very basic. So I started building up these clubs and these events and these parties. And I also didn't want you to worry about payment and stuff. So I started going, hey, it's $500 for the party. Oh, it's $1,000 for the party. All your drink and food's included, but it's $1,000. So all of a sudden I knew that if I was having 50 people in there, I was getting $50,000, you know? And it started to do really well. And then I was going to like realtors and saying, what's the biggest property you've got that you're trying to sell? Because guess what? I know 200 of the richest people in Macau. Let's have the party at your mansion. So all of a sudden I'm not paying for the mansion. And then I would go to people like Mercedes or Cartier and go, hey, how would you like to be in a room with 200 of the richest people in the world in the most expensive mansion in Hong Kong? And they'd be like, oh, we'd love to. Great. That'd be $50,000. Before you know it, I was making $250,000. Exactly.
Yeah.
I was putting all the dots together to give you an interesting night, putting you in a place where normally you would never have been in, with people of your standard. So I was charging you in advance. I was making it fun. I was giving you passwords to get in. I was having all of this kind of thing to focus on the detail of you having a good night, to endorse your relationship with me so that I could eventually get a job with you. It was daft. I was
Did
making-
Did anybody ever offer you a job?
Do you know, it was the only time in my life I never asked for anything. Wow. Yeah, that my wife brought that to my attention. I've asked for people to get married at the Vatican, go down to the Titanic. You know, I go and I ask for things and I get them done. The only time I never asked in my life was these people. And before I realized it, I've been doing it for like 4 years. We were making serious money. And my wife turned around to me and she said, what are you going to do for a job? And I said, I don't know, babe. You know, I'm looking for one. She's like, don't you realize you've got one? You know, you've created one. And she said to me, she said, I've never had to count up anyone. You know what it's like when, I can't assume for you, but I remember being in London, walking around a supermarket, counting as you're putting the things in a basket. You know, going to the bar and trying to work out how much the beers are because you can't afford too much because you've only got £5.50. You know, I remember calculating things like that. And credit cards maxing out. And my wife said to me, she said, I haven't had to worry about my credit card. I haven't had to worry about our rent. She said, we're driving a new car. She said, I've not had to worry about any of that for years. She said, maybe you've got something. And that was the first time we actually looked inward as to what we'd built and went, rather than me looking for a job, maybe I have one.
Yeah. And I love, so good, because a lot of those pieces were not in the book. So thank you for sharing all of that. And the through line, and I think that you've really become such a master at, is relationships and what's in it for them. I know that you cultivate the win-win, but my experience of you, Steve, is that you're really looking out for other people first. And as a byproduct, that benefits you. But you're not looking at like, okay, wait, I really want the win to come back. So what do I do first for them? I know that you're saying you're looking for a job, but just even near their stories, you're constantly just seeing how can I make people be in awe and wonder, how can I support them? And you hear it all the time about the law of giving and receiving, right? People say, in order to receive, you got to give, go give value before you ask for anything back. You live by that. And you're such a testament to how that truly does work, because I think people know the idea in their mind, but even when they go to give, they're still, their deepest intention is, but what's in it for me? And with my experience with you is still a, no, what is it in it for you first? And then, cool, if it comes back. But yeah, and I said this offline and Steve said, don't say this, but you are so humble about your successes as well. And you're so kind to everybody. You really are. And it's such a beautiful thing to witness, especially as someone of, you know, who you spend your time with, your level of success. You still have such a deep level of humility and kindness to everybody around you. So you can have my water too.
Yeah, that's all lies. she's made that up. She's talking about a different Steve Sims. But I'm sure there's a couple of people out there going, he's not bloody nice. Probably it's my kids that are saying that about now.
Ah, come on. So in your book, which is such a great like how-to guide on how to make things happen, you've got so many good tips on business as well as in life. They're so down to earth. They're so practical. You can apply it immediately. I'd love to drop in about some of the different ones, especially ones that really resonated for me. Okay. But one of them in particular, because this, again, this is how you've built what you've built, is all around relationships. Mm-hmm. One of your greatest assets in life and business are your relationships. And I believe the place where you experience the most fulfillment in life as well. And I'm inspired by how you cultivated so many extraordinary relationships. So when you meet someone, from that moment to then how they become part of Steve Sims' tribe, how does that work?
Well, they're trees, which is a really ridiculous thing, but it was actually one of my kids came up with it. We had, when you meet someone, okay, that's a very, very, very new, vulnerable relationship, very vulnerable. Now, when you meet someone, and I'm very selfish with my time. If I want to meet someone, it's because they fascinate me. I feel as though I can help them. You know, I'm really bad at networking events. Like, I haven't had a business card for, 18 years. And I remember the last business cards I got, they were spelt wrong, so I didn't bother taking them out with me. But the bottom line of it is, when I go to an event, I'll speak to someone. If they're only after my business card, I don't want to talk to them.
Exactly.
You know?
Yep.
And I will say to people, and this sometimes scares them, again, because of my looking at, but people are turning around, they go, hey, how are you? And I'll be like, oh, why do you want to talk to me? And I'll shut up, you know, and they'll kind of like, well, you know, I heard about this. Oh, that sounds great. But some people will be like, oh, you'd be like that, and they'll wander off. I want to have a relationship. I don't want to have a collection of business cards in my top drawer. So whenever I meet someone, I want to engage. I want to talk to them. I want to understand what it is they're after. I do this. Maybe there's a combination. Maybe I can help you. Maybe I can benefit you. But all of that's going on. But it's the seed. Now, if you're given a seed for a tree, every seed starts off really minute. It's really small. And there are a million ways that you can kill it. You can do nothing with it. You can stick it in the ground and not feed it, not water it, not care for it, not prune it, not protect it. And the result will be the exact same thing every single time. Thing will be dead. Mm-hmm. Okay? But if you plant it deep enough and if you protect it and you feed it and you water it and you pay attention to it and you nurture it, maybe shield it as it breaks through the soil, if you focus on that, maybe in 6 months to a year to 2 years, that'll be a strong root, a strong foundation, a strong tree. I believe that's the same with relationships. If you meet someone at a bar, you shake their hand, and then you bump into them in another bar in a year's time, your relationship has not grown. It's not been nurtured. It's nothing more than a passing glance. If you think about the amount of people that you walk into a clubhouse with, an industry event, and you know their first name. You don't know their last name. You don't know what drink they like. You don't know what their favorite food is. You don't know where they went on holiday. You don't know any of those things. Well, I had to break it to you, but you don't actually have a relationship. And I felt that, for me, I want to know what's going on you. So when I meet someone and I'm chatting with them and they've got a drink in their hand and it's a Negroni, it's an old fashioned, it's a glass of champagne. The funny thing is, I'll make notes.
I do too.
Yeah, and there you go. Yeah. Perfect. I'll make notes. Wore a grey T-shirt, was drinking a glass of champagne. I asked him, did he like champagne? He said, no, not really. It's the only bloody thing they got. Well, do you like? I like a good IPA. Likes IPA. Then I'll say to him in a few weeks' time, hey, I really enjoyed the conversation. I know you mentioned you like beer, so there's a great tap house around the corner for me. Let's meet there. And he'd be like, wow, you paid attention. You know, He wants to be with me because I pay attention. Now, the bottom line of it is, I don't want to get, you know, like a therapist here, but we're pack animals. For as much crap that's going on in our life at the moment, we really haven't much evolved from just walking up. You know, you walk down the street and you walk past the bush and the bush rattles, you're scared. You know, it's fight or flight. It's something we react the same thing. We see someone we like that's wearing something that attracts us and we look. Okay, so with all the different campaigns going on, all the different scandals, all the different revolutions and empowerments, we're still the bloody same. We want to relate with other people. We want to connect with other people on the same level that we give out. That's what I do. And the thing is, as we are now in a world where we're talking to Alexa and Siri more and more and more, the ability to communicate is dying. And so with me, I want to talk to someone. Someone will send me an email and I will do this stupid thing. I'll phone them. And I'll phone them and I go, hey, Stephanie, I got your email. Thanks a lot for that. But and here's my lie. Here's my lie. And probably everyone's now going to call me a liar for this. But as you and I both know, I don't have a car.
Yep.
Okay. So I'll be sitting in the garden and I'll phone them and I'll go, hey, Stephanie, how are you? Hey, I'm in the car. So I thought I'd give you a call while I'm driving down the road, okay? And I'll be in the garden, and I'll say, I got your email about so-and-so, but I thought rather than just go backwards and forwards, I'd get to the root of it. I want to ask you, why is that important? I have never, ever had a phone call where I've then gone back and provided the client with what they asked me in the email. Because they'll say things, oh, I want to go to Italy, and I want to do a tour around southern Italy. Oh, why do you want to do that? Oh, because I've not done this and done that. Okay, great. When do you want to do it? Oh, I want to do it on there. Have you thought about the weather conditions? No, I haven't. Okay. Well, if you've not been there before, rather than you spacing all your time trying to get all of southern Italy in, why don't we concentrate on just two pinnacolaris?
Yeah.
And you just focus to the client. I've always believed that the client, what the client says is not always right.
Mm-hmm.
The client doesn't know what they don't know. That's your job.
Yeah. Well, even when I coach them or do hypnosis, what they think is the issue is not the issue.
Never is.
Yeah.
Never absolutely is. In the book, you know, I always ask why three times.
Yep. I love that.
And someone will say, hey, I want to do this. And I'll be like, that's fantastic. I'm hearing you. Why is that important? Well, it's, you know, because, oh, great. So what needs to happen in order for this to be that startling moment? You know, what happened in order for this to become the dream? And you just grill it down. I call it using my inner Sherlock Holmes. I want to find out where the core is. I had a client, and I don't want to go all over the place, but I had a client that contacted me one day because he wanted to meet the rock band Journey.
Oh, I love this.
And yes. There you go. So he wanted to meet the band. The whole focus was, I just want to meet the band. I want to shake their hand, you know, backstage. All right. Why do you want to do that? You know, we went through it. It turned out that he was the lead singer of a Journey cover band when he was at college.
Mm-hmm.
Through sickness, health, rich, poor, marriage, relationship, this weird thing called life that goes up and down. And let's be blunt, entrepreneurs are worse.
We
can go from buying a mansion to not being able to afford a toilet roll.
Yep.
Very quickly as an entrepreneur. And he said that through all of that, Journey had provided him the tunes of that chapter of his life. Mm. And he just wanted to go back to him and tell him how monumental that music had been, how sometimes it got him up to get going. Now, fast forward to today, he's not worried about money. He's very successful. He's healthy. The rest is good. But I said to him, you're telling me that to meet these guys after they've just played out to like 20,000 people, shake their hands as they're coming off stage, all hot, adrenaline's going, sweaty. They're not going to remember your name by the time they hit the changing rooms. Mm. But is that really going to be the climax? Is that going to be the grand ending to your movie of which Journey's actually the theme, the soundtrack for? He said, oh. I said, we got to do better than that. So I spoke to Journey and I got him involved and we found ways to make the win. And we actually got him to sing live on stage.
Amazing.
As the shortest term lead singer of Journey. He sang in front of San Diego. At the time, I think it was called the Cricket Amphitheater. I think it's called Verizon now, but yeah. It was Cricket at the time. And he sang live on stage, all the pyrotechnics, the sound, did this whole gig with the band, and he was the lead singer for Fortunes.
Mm, it was so awesome. And you made a benefit for autism, and you also raised a ton of money for that because the drummer's son was autistic.
We found a link, We always try to find a mutual link. Mm-hmm. And we found that the drummer's son had autism, and he was a great advocate for Autism Speaks. And my client's brother's son had autism. So we went, hey, this is fulfilling a dream for your one of your ultimate fans, but let's hide it and wrap it around Autism Speaks. Let's bring awareness. All the money, let's use that as a donation. So we were able to support a charity that Journey found true to the heart, and so did my client.
So good. You know, I love, so I want to make sure everybody caught what you said is the three whys. If you, instead of just taking what people say, ask them why three times to get them really to the core of what matters to them. And you also said in your book, you're like, when you ask people to tell you their wildest dreams, they often dilute it.
Oh, every single time.
Why is that? Why do you think people do that?
I think they're scared. I think they're embarrassed. I don't think people are scared to fail. I think they're scared that people will see them fail. And I think when I turn around to you, in fact, you can play this game yourself. Turn around to your best mate and say, hey, if anything could happen to you in the world, you could do absolutely anything, what would it be? And they may turn around and go, oh, I'd like to be in a hot tub with a bunch of Victoria's Secret models, or I'd like to play piano with Elton John, or I'd like to skydive over Mount Everest. The next few seconds is the funny bit. Because the next few seconds, I'll turn around and I go, yeah, but I don't know Elton John. I don't know how I would do it. And they will spend the next 60 seconds telling you all the reasons why it can't be done rather than focusing on the one reason why it should. Mm. Now, I think people are scared of that. And so I think we should focus and say, hey, I really want to skydive over Everest. Before the excuses kick in, ask yourself one question. What's the first thing I need to do to get closer to that happening?
Mm. So good.
And that could be going to a local skydive school. It could be visiting Nepal. It could be anything, but it's the first step. When I had a client contact me because they wanted to get married in the Vatican by the Pope, the first thing I did was I thought, okay, who do I know that's powerful in Italy? I'm going to make a phone call. And that was it. You know, first step, who do I know in Italy? You know, it's pointless me phoning someone in Denver if I want someone to get married in the Vatican. So I focused on someone. Did I know anyone there? First person I phoned, waste of time.
I love that.
Second person? No, it just, but I got the person I needed.
Yeah. And I love that, again, what you said. The moment you have allow yourself to dream, ask yourself, what's the first step?
Absolutely.
What's the first step? Like, interrupt the bullshit that wants to come up to tell you you can't. Take the first step. And then just, I would say, even keep asking that question over and over. So it almost shifts your attention away from the fear and the it can't happen to the how can I do it? How can I do it? How can I do it? And I really also love in one of your chapters that so resonated with me, because it took me a while to get through my relationship with failure. And you drop deep into about what failure is, and that it's not like to not say that it's failure, but it's just more about discovery. And I thought it was fascinating that you said in the Thai language that there's no direct translation of the English word no, that they only have a word for yes and try, but they didn't have a common word for no, which blew my mind.
Yeah.
That's insane, which, I mean, if we didn't have no in our vocabulary, what could that do? But I'd love for you to talk about the alternative word for fail and how that can support us in moving through those moments of time.
Well, I don't want to name drop, but I have some very, you know,
go ahead and name drop.
Okay. I have some very powerful people that I know. And I remember walking through SpaceX with a gentleman by the name of Elon Musk. And I was saying, we were just making idle chit chat before we actually went into an event that we were doing there. And I said to him, this is absolutely amazing. If anyone wants to know what SpaceX looks like, and it's very hard to actually see what it looks like inside. Do you remember the first Marvel movie, Iron Man?
Yes.
Okay. In that movie, he, and I forget what Stark, I think his name is, walks through his rocket factory. Well, what most people don't know is that's actually Elon Musk's factory.
Really?
Okay.
What?
That's a true story.
Cool.
So if you go back to the first Iron Man movie and go where Stark actually walks through his factory, that's SpaceX. So I'm walking through and there's literally fuselage and there's rockets and they're testing things. And I said to him, this is absolutely incredible. I said, you know, did you ever think you'd be making rockets? And he didn't really answer my question, but he did turn around. He said, do you know, they always laugh at you before they applaud. And I was like, damn, that's true. Failure happens when you allow it. You know, the fight's over, not when you go down, it's when you stop getting up. And so every time something goes wrong, you didn't fail at anything. You just discovered that that's not the way to go. You know, that's not the way to do it. You just got educated on something that, believe it or not, may well help you in the future. You may have got a result from trying something that made something go yellow. 10 years' time, you may think to yourself, well, I wonder how I make it go yellow. I know. And you'll go back to that point in time where you had, when it became yellow. There's no such thing as failure. I really don't believe there is. I try so many things. So many things do not provide me the result that I actually want them to, that gave me an education on what not to do or what I could do in the future to get the result that just happened from that. Now, it may sound a bit funny, but failure is something that you accept as to whether or not it's going to stop you going forward. And the people that I know, the people that I work with, the people that I coach, the people that I do trainings and courses with, the entrepreneurs in the world, they've never allowed any of their failures to define them. They've allowed it to refine them. And it's that mentality that has caused them to actually go, all right, that's where I go from there. It's the next run in the ladder that's got them closer to where they want to be. And I've noticed all of the failures out there are the people that allow it to stop them. I personally think Elon Musk is a serial failure. And I'm thrilled about that. How many times did you see his rocket? Do you remember that he had the... He had those gas tanks, didn't he?
Yep.
And they would come down and they would land on that floating platform in the ocean and they would fall over and they would explode, okay? How many times did you see that on TV?
Good amount of time.
Quite a few times, wasn't it? Because they would come down and it was quite exciting. This rocket would come down, tip over, and then blow up into massive flames. When was the last time you saw that happen? On TV.
It usually...
When was the last time you saw a fuselage land on there and explode?
Aside from him?
No, his. When was the last time you saw one of his explode?
That I can't recall how long. Time is like a weird thing for me.
Exactly. The whole point is they don't show it anymore.
Mm.
Why don't they show it? Because he lands them.
Mm.
It was only interesting when it was failing.
Yeah.
When the bloody thing lands properly, they went, oh, success is land. You haven't seen it. Hasn't been on the TV for bloody months now. Because he learned how it went wrong to make it go right. Now, it's no longer.
Yeah.
People don't want to stare at it.
Yeah.
I had a horrible situation that brought all of this to my life, to my forefront. I was in a place called Glendale Galleria, you know, the big shopping mall. And it's close to us here in Los Angeles. And I'm walking with my wife, and in front of me are these two guys, and in front of them was one of the largest women I've ever seen. Now, I know this may be politically correct, incorrect, but she was one of the fattest ladies I have ever seen. And she annoyed me because she had a bunch of, and I think they may have been Target shopping bags, but she had her arms out to her side, like 9 o'clock and 3 o'clock, which with her girth was actually making it hard for people to get past her. So I thought this was a bit inconsiderate of her, right? And I'm looking at this woman thinking, if she only brought her bloody arms in, people would be able to get past her easier, okay? But hey-ho, that was just what was going through my mind. As that was going through my mind, she tripped and fell over. Now, this is where it gets nasty. Because she had her arms at 3 and 9 o'clock to her side...
She fell flat on her face.
Bingo.
Oh.
The bags went flying. The slap that I heard, I can still recall. I tried to get past these two guys in front to try and get her. The two guys also tried to save her. There was no stopping this woman. She was 300 plus pound easy. There was no way we could have stopped her going down. She may have hurt us had we got there in time. She may have fallen on us and hurt us. But I got there and she was face planted on the floor. Bags went everywhere. The guys gently brought her onto her bottom. She's now sat up in the Galleria. People are starting to crowd around her. I'm grabbing her bags, bringing it in. My wife's doing the same. These guys are doing the same. And as she sat very uneloquently with her legs out, very shook up, between her legs, we're putting all of these bags. So they're close to her, so no one can steal her bags, okay? And all of a sudden, she starts coming to. She's very red. I don't know what she damaged, okay? But she's very red, very shaken up. All of a sudden, she starts looking around everywhere like a prairie dog, just looking all over the place. And I said to her, I caught her eyes. I said, excuse me, you know, all your bags are here. Are they not here? Have we lost something? Let me know if we've lost something and we can quickly grab it. Because she's now got an audience around her. And she just turned around to me and she looked me in the eyes and she said, I just wanted to make sure no one was videoing me. Now, this woman had fallen over. Now, at that point, the paramedics came over and they grabbed us and they asked us to step away and we did that. And I thought to myself, that girl in the morning is going to wake up. She may even have woke up in hospital. She had no protection when she went down. She wasn't the fittest flea on the farm. So she could have hurt herself very, very easily. But all she was concerned about was someone actually seeing her and laughing at her. And as I said from the beginning, very few people are actually frightened of failing now, but we've become scared, petrified of people seeing us fail. And the people that succeed don't care. Elon Musk doesn't give a rat's ass how many times his rocket failed. It only had to work once. Jeff Bezos has no care of the times he went through with all the issues with Amazon. He's now the richest man in the planet. Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, roll them off.
Yep, Michael Jackson, Oprah, it's all, there's a beautiful...
Henry Ford.
Three pages in your book.
Colonel Sanders. Oof. All of these people had no care how many times it took them to fail to succeed, because the funny thing is, you only need to succeed once in order for the failures to go away.
Yep. And kind of what we said before, thank you for that story, and that's powerful. Even for someone like her to just go, I hope no one's videoing. Like, it actually hit
terrifying,
me.
Terrifying, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So sad.
But what we said before is everyone's staring at that, I don't want to fail, or it's impossible, I don't want to look stupid, instead of just aiming their attention, their focus on what it is that they want and taking the steps forward, you know, and being okay with the failure. And I just want to highlight what you said. Instead of saying fail, say it's a discovery. Because for me—
it's education.
Yeah, for me. But even when I hear people say that you learn or you grow from failure, it didn't really land in the way that— saying, oh, I just discovered something new.
No.
There's a beautiful energy to the word discovery for me. And so I loved it when I read that in your book.
Yes, yeah, they say experience is something that you get 2 seconds after you needed it. It's one of those things that as you're growing, you look at certain things as you want to avoid them. And failing is one of those things you want to avoid. You want to avoid getting the cuts, the scrapes, the pain. But, you know, those are the things that empower you. Yes. You know, I've remembered in my life being broke so many times, okay, and I've remembered coming out of it. Now, the funny thing is I'm sitting here now. I'm quite happy. My life's quite nice. But, you know, if I lost it all tomorrow, I know what it's like to clean the toilets again, you know, and I know I'm capable of doing so. So there's this empowerment that goes, hey, all right, God dealt that card. Now how do I play it? Because how I play it is my choice.
Mm.
And that's the beautiful thing about entrepreneurs. We become empowered by our failures, by our scrapes, by our scars. Yeah. And we should relish in them. We should rejoice in them.
Yeah. And I also even think when people hear, those are the greatest stories that people tell. It's like the failure and what you did in the face of the failure versus, hey, look at all the success I have. Isn't this great? It's like people don't care about it. And it's not what I think, again, grows you or generates the most fulfillment for ourselves when we're able to look at an obstacle and overcome it and keep rising up. I know another obstacle that people have are the stories that we are told that we need to be somebody else. And you have a story in the book sharing about the worst picture ever taken of you in Monaco.
The Ferrari.
Yes.
Yeah.
Share about that, because it's such a good thing to remind people to be you, to be yourself and not someone else.
Again, I've learned a lot of these lessons, and you know, you can tell people them, but 9 times out of 10, it still won't settle in them until they've done it themselves. I'm for the purpose of people that can't see me. You know, I'm a bald, goatee, earrings, tattoos, riding up on motorcycles. That's me, you know, and always in a black t-shirt. Why? Because I haven't got to think about what I put on. It was chilly today here in Venice, so but it's still a black t-shirt.
Sure,
I've got a long sleeve black t-shirt. So I'm very easy in that situation. And I had been running my concierge firm and my part, whatever the bloody thing was called. I'd been working with all of these people for about 3 to 4, 5 years now. And I got this gig in Monaco, and I had to throw this party, and I did. And we got this yacht, and it was this 3-story yacht. Funny thing was, the thing that caught me was this yacht had 3 elevators on it. Okay. I'd never been on a boat with elevators, and I was like a kid in a toy store. I was running around going up and down these elevators because I just thought it was hysterical going up a lift on a boat.
Yeah.
So we had this party, and the daft thing is it was about 2 months out before the party happened, and I started to get that self-doubt that entrepreneurs get, and we start questioning things. Now, entrepreneurs, we're a funny breed. I told you before, we're diseased.
We sure are.
And there's one of these sicknesses that we go through of self-doubt. Now, the easiest way for everything to go wrong is for entrepreneurs to suddenly start looking at it and going, oh, how can I make that better? If it's working, leave it the hell alone, okay? But no, we don't do that as entrepreneurs. We go, okay, that's working. Now how can I screw it up? And I remember I was turning up to clients, and I'm on about all over the planet. I was now living in Switzerland. I would fly into Indonesia and I'd rent a motorcycle. Why? Because I love bikes. Mm-hmm. I'd rent a motorbike and I'd turn up and see my client on a rented Ducati or a rented Harley Davidson. Okay. No matter where it was in the world, I was turning up on a bike. They were used to me walking through the door with a crash helmet in my hand. Okay. I would fly with my crash helmet because I always wanted my helmet, but that's how I was doing it. So I'm in Monaco in the next few months. I'm thinking, oh, hang on a minute. I work with some of the richest people in the planet. And I was working with certain people that owned countries.
Whoa.
So I was that standard, mm-hmm. you know? There were airports I was flying into that I never went through customs. They were meeting me as I got off the plane and just taking me to where I needed to go and then dropping me off again. I was not going through customs. It was a funny old life. And so I thought to myself, I've got to change. I've got to be looking more respectful. I've got to do it. So I went out, and first thing was I took all my earrings off. Okay. And
even the one on your eyebrow right there?
Yep. Yep. I took my eyebrow ring off. I took my, you know, I've got, what have I got? 3, 4, 5. What have I got? I don't know. One in the eye, 2 in the ears, yep. You know. And I thought, I'm getting rid of those. And I started getting some suits. I had some tailor-made suits. I bought suits. Few of them.
I could not imagine you in a suit.
No. I had tailor-made suits, which was a beautiful experience.
Yeah.
Loved getting it. But I've now got these suits. And then I thought to myself, I can't turn up on a motorbike in a suit. And I thought, I've got to buy a Ferrari. Now, I had been working with Ferrari, so I managed to get this discount. And I bought this Ferrari. And I went down to Monaco in this Ferrari. I'm wearing the suits, got a 20 grand watch on. I'm thinking, look at this. I've got all the trappings of a successful person. Did the party. The party's going crazy. We got anyone that knows the Monaco Grand Prix knows that the Cannes Film Festival finishes the week before. So we had icons on this, but we had Terminator on this boat. Mm-hmm. We had anyone that was anyone was on this boat. And I got off this boat. You know, I didn't want to be there any longer. So I got off the boat and there's my Ferrari there. Next to us is this yacht that was bigger. And I reversed the car up and I got my wife to take a photograph of me in a suit leaning up against this Ferrari in front of a yacht that I didn't own. Now, bear in mind, the other one was three stories and had
elevator in that one.
Three elevators and had Hollywood superstars on it, A-listers. And I was getting a picture in front of a boat that was bigger that I had nothing to do with. Now, I went home and, yeah, it was in the late 90s. This was in 97. And I sent off the roll of film, you know, when you stick them in the envelope and, you know, somewhere within about 3 weeks to 3 years, you know, you get your photographs back. And I got the photographs back and I'm looking through this photograph and there's that picture of me. There was no footage of me on the boat at the party. There was no footage of, there was no selfies at the time. There was no Instagrams at the time. And I suddenly realized that I wasn't in that picture. I had bought a Ferrari for you. I'd bought it to impress you. I'd bought suits to impress you. I was wearing all of these shields and these covers to try and impress you. Forget the fact that I've been in business for 5 years. Forget the fact that I had pulled this party together by just turning up on a motorcycle. I'd got weak and I had sold my soul to Armani and Ferrari and Audemars Piguet to impress clients that I already had.
Who love you for you.
And I didn't show up. This, you know, Don Johnson Miami Vice character turned up. It was frightening. And it sent me into a downward spiral. Mm. And literally, I got very badly drunk for about 3 days, pulled myself out of it. Thankfully, my wife helped me. And I put all the suits in the back of the cupboard. Never ever did wear those again. They went to a charity store, got rid of the bikes. I got rid of the car. And I thought to myself, if you don't like me, then don't work with me. But I'm not going to sell me for you. You know, we all do stuff mm-hmm. that, you know, to impress, to look better. And that's fine. You want to be the best impression of you. But that wasn't an impression of me. That was an impression of
an image of you that you thought they wanted.
How can you work that calculation out? You know, a mathematician could not work that out. It made no sense. So I thought to myself, I am not going to give any effort in being me. This is me, okay? Like it, great. Don't like it, we'll be fine. I'm not going to be offended. But I am not going to allow me to use any effort to try and be someone else that I'm not. I want 100% of my effort in doing what I do, not in what I look at.
Yeah. And you got right with yourself. I think that's what it is. A lot of times we don't get right with ourselves. We betray ourselves for other people. And yet you're like, no. I want to like me, not try to pretend to be something for someone else. So I really love that, Steve.
And it's a cancer. That mm-hmm. shit will eat you up. You can't get rid of cancer with a couple of tablets at night. You know, mm-hmm. that bitch has got to be cut out.
Yep.
And I'm lucky that I caught it when I did. God knows where it could have taken me. I've seen people that I've liked. And I hate to say the word liked, but they got so consumed in impressing you, they've hocked their house to be able to buy timeshare on a jet just so they can get the bloody selfies. It's ridiculous. But we see it now.
Yeah.
You look on Instagram, and I did a post a little while ago that I lost people. I got hate mail for. I took my wife.
The one in prison.
No, not the one in prison. I actually lost people on that as well. I spoke at an event in Phuket. And while I was in Phuket, we actually lived in Bangkok, me and my wife, and she'd never got to see the elephants. So I took her up to Chiang Mai to see the elephants. And there's a picture of me, and it's really cool. It looks like this elephant's smiling, and I'm patting him on the trunk. And my wife took the picture, and I actually posted on it that, no, I don't own this elephant like you don't own that jet. And I posted that. And I had people just like, having a go at me. And I just thought it was funny, you know? And that's where it went. Some people liked it, some people didn't. But I've noticed one thing. I have a lot of clients with a lot of jets. I've got clients who have got multiple jets. Not one of them's ever taken a picture of themselves on that mm-hmm. jet. Most of the time, people don't. They don't take pictures of themselves on jets because they own them.
Yeah. No, absolutely. You know, I used to, when I first moved to LA in the early 2000s, I was working at the Sports Club LA. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of kind of well-known people who came through those doors. And I would be there. When I first started working there, I was at the front desk doing the reception, and you'd see these, you know, very, very wealthy, very well-known people coming in with ratty jeans, ratty t-shirts, not showing off anything at all, trying to be humble and almost hiding themselves versus flashing and showing it off. So, yeah, it's so interesting.
You got to ask yourself, when someone is wearing that much, then what's the purpose? Now, I know guys that have got beautiful watches because they love watches. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering, are you buying that watch to impress me? So are you buying that for me because you're not confident? So I will ask people and I'll say, hey, I love the watch. You know, where's the watch from? And they may just go, oh, I bought it from this store. And you soon realize that they have no idea what they're wearing. So they bought it for somebody else. That's usually a very short conversation.
Yep. What's your next once-in-a-lifetime experience that you're going to create for yourself? You do this for everybody else. What's next for you, Steve?
Well, I love experiences. I'm a great believer that we should all be collecting experiences, not pink slips. And I love doing different things. You actually brought up the fact that I was in jail. Jason Gaynard took me to jail last year to a level 4 maximum security jail up in Kern. Yeah. And it changed my life. And so since then, I've taken just under 100 entrepreneurs up there, and we go up there and we train, teach, integrate with people that are serving multiple life sentences and teach them about being an entrepreneur. And to be honest with you, as much as we are teaching them about what they can do when they come out, they're actually revealing a lot to us. I would say, without a doubt, we get more out of it than they do. Yeah. And so I've been going back to jail quite a bit and really enjoying that. And I try to take people back. And I try to get people to get uncomfortable with being uncomfortable. We can conquer so much more when we lose the fear of failure, we lose intimidation, we lose the paralysis by analysis. If you can find that you thrive in situations where you are not comfortable, then you can go so far. And that's what I try to get people to do. So I'm always trying to experience things, you know, riding over here to Venice Beach, hanging out with you. Woo. That's a cool experience. I get a ride home via the beach. Cool experience. So I'm all about making sure I experience life.
Steve, I wish we had another hour. I've got more questions. Again, thank you so much for being here today. Thank you for sharing all of your stories, which I love, your wisdom, your knowledge. Your book, which I've got my Sharpie out so Steve can sign it, because we're going to do a giveaway for the book for you listeners. But thank you. Guys, get your hands on this book. It's invaluable. And I love how you also, at the end of each chapter, really kind of highlight the nuggets and the takeaways. That's powerful too. So then that really lands for the reader on what they can do to break through their own impossible to make everything they want possible. So thank you, Steve.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks.
Yeah. I've got a few more questions for you before we close this out.
Go for it.
Okay. What is something unique about you that most people don't know?
I'm actually remarkably dull. I love gardening. I love barbecuing. I love cleaning the bikes. I like sitting in the garden with a good old fashioned with my feet on my dogs. So
and
I'm a very
And a whiskey.
Oh yeah, nice old fashioned in there. I'm remarkably dull. I live vicariously through being challenged by other people.
I don't think you're dull. when you're in a dark place, what's your go-to to get out?
Ooh. I have gone through many dark places. My dad actually, big thick Irish lad, once said to me, for what seemed like no reason whatsoever, because we weren't even talking. We were walking down the street and he puts his hand on my shoulder as we're walking. He didn't make eye contact. And he said to me, he said, son, no one ever drowned by falling in the water. They drowned by staying there. And then he takes his hand off my shoulder and carried on walking. And I was about 14 years old and I remember stopping and going, what the hell was that? and it wasn't until later on that every time things go wrong, I realized, okay, I've fallen in the water here. I can drown or I can stand up. And usually it's just that mental shift. And I've become very used to just going forward to those things that fear me. So when shit happens, when things go wrong, I go forward and I fight it. I go head on. Never try to hide it. Never try to keep those behind or keep them secret or hide those pains. That doesn't work for anybody, and it will hurt you and it will take longer to recover. So I just now stand up and I go, all right, shit's hit the fan. What are we going to do about it? And that's usually the first thing I do. I stand up and I announce it.
Beautiful. And knowing what you know now, what advice would you give your 10-year-old self?
Oh, well, that's easy. I would tell him to avoid the cheap whiskey.
At 10?
Well, yeah, I wasn't drinking much at 10. But that's the only thing I would do, because every time I failed, got hurt, got screwed over, been sued, been broke, been ripped off, been hurt, I've come out better and stronger. So the question needs to be asked, would I have got to that place had it not been for the trauma that I went through? So knowing where I am now, would I really want him to miss out on some of those beautiful lessons? So no, I would just say, stay off the shit whiskey and you'll be fine.
What's your favorite brand of whiskey?
I love Japanese, and I love Hibiki Harmony is my go-to with a big lump of ice, and I'm happy with that.
Great. How can people connect with you, Steve?
So I have, you mentioned about the cheat sheet in the book. I have a website, stevedsims.com. If you subscribe there to the emails, you actually get the cheat sheet for free.
Yes.
And there's one of my favorite videos on there that talks about my Ferrari day in Monaco called the Chug Test. But I'm on Steve D. Sims. You can also find me on Instagram, Steve D. Sims. I'm everywhere as Steve D. Sims with just one M.
Yep. Thank you again, guys. Go get the book. We barely scratched the surface of all the incredible tips in there. So if you love already the incredible ones you've heard today, you're going to get a heck of a lot more when you go through the book.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Steve. Steve is a true magic maker. Now, it's amazing how Steve's mind works to really make anything happen. And I love how he's always focused on the solution and achieving the ultimate goal. Because I think in life, you know, we often focus our attention in the wrong direction. It's often focused on not failing, not being good enough, or not losing love, or getting hurt, or being rejected, or judged, or abandoned, and staying safe. Versus focusing on what we really want and taking the inspired action steps to make it happen. You know, you are so capable of making your wildest dreams come true and achieving anything you want. You literally have everything you need right now to make what you want into a reality. And it all starts with choosing to believe that first. Choosing to believe that you are capable, because you are, and choosing to believe that you can have what you want, and then just taking the daily action steps towards it. Now, you want to be open to how you're going to make it happen, but you got to make sure you believe that you will. And when you do, you will always uncover the path to get there. Even if it's a little bit windy, you will get there. And then mix in some of Steve's awesome strategies that he shares to achieve any goal in his book, Blue Fishing. And yo, it is a done deal. You will get in life and biz what it is that you want. Now, again, Steve's book is amazing. And the book is about taking action, taking risks. It's about making business personal, building trust, and creating the experience. It's got common sense, down-to-earth, practical, and extremely useful info. This book will inspire you to take action in your life, and it will help you achieve your dream if you take the advice to heart and use it. So if you want a free copy, again, make sure you share today's episode out. And to enter to win a copy of Steve's book, again, take a screenshot of this episode that you're listening to, write a little comment about the episode on the post, and then tag me at I am Stephanie Kwong. Make sure you tag Steve at Steve D. Sims and post it up. And again, I'll announce the winner at the end of the week. And I hope that it's you. Because you guys, you already heard how much fire Steve was laying down in today's episode. That was just a snippet of what's inside of his book. So make sure you enter to win, or even just go get yourself a copy.
All right. So if there's someone that you know who could benefit from this episode, pretty please share it with them. And if you got value from this episode and it feels aligned for you, I would be so deeply grateful if you'd leave me a 5-star review on iTunes, because that means we can support even more people to rise higher together. Remember, every review helps. So it would mean the world to me if you just take a quick moment to write a review for the show. And if you've already done one, thank you so, so very much. And if you guys want to connect with Steve and to get a copy of his book, Blue Fishing, The Art of Making Anything Happen, all the links are in the show notes, and that is over at stephaniekwong.com/EP59. Okay, beautiful people, until next time, I'm sending you so much love.